The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, it's all about empowering people. Different insights, from why we should enjoy chia seeds to what you should do about those soft drinks and what they'll do to your risk of heart disease. I have the latest on foods that heal. And then we have a special commentary from Norm Stampler, Paramilitary Policing is a Disaster, from Yes Magazine. I'll be asking you to call in and give your points of view on that. I'll give my ideas of what we could do today, immediately, to help our economy, to help lessen debt, without having to cut any of our social services. Also, my guest in the second part of our program is Greg Palast. Greg will be continuing the conversation we began earlier, and we're going to talk specifically about some things the audience is not aware of. For example, the complete truth on British Petroleum. Not just with the Deepwater Horizon blow-up, but even the Arctic pipelines, the Exxon Valdez incidents, the prior offshore drilling accidents and corruption and cover-ups on British Petroleum trying to save costs by ignoring safety. We all know of the Glass-Steagall Act. We know it was our major protection to keep the banks from using our savings and other money in casino gambling. That was done away with under the Clinton administration. At that time, he had Lawrence Summers and he had Robert Rubin. But no one knows the truth about what really went on. We will today. It was all about corruption. We're calling these people out, from President, former President Clinton and all the others, as corrupt. There was a banking cartel that was corrupt. They intended to bust up the Glass-Steagall Act. So the big banks, Citicorp, Sanford Weill, who had a hidden role in this, to the minor trade treaty, the Financial Service Agreement, into a new law that would force 152 nations to begin purchasing their toxic assets. This was not unintended consequences. These people knew what they were doing. They should be held accountable. We'll talk about it for the first time. The role of the oil companies in multinational globalization, which drains the resources and money from developing countries and impoverishes the population. You'll get that also. As you can see, we have a lot to share with you, including the latest on fracking fluids. The deeper, the dirtier. A new study finds bottom-of-the-barrel flowback fluids much more contaminated. And also, yesterday, while I was driving at a film shoot in the eastern part of the United States, the driver had on Rush Limbaugh. And Rush Limbaugh said, there is no global warming, there is no science behind it. It's all been a fraud. Well, no. As almost in everything he does, he's wrong. But very specific information today on the extreme weather. It's only going to get worse. And it's because of climate change. Let's begin. As you see, we have a lot to cover. First up, everyone should know by now that when you take a sugary drink, more often than not, you're taking in some form of either pure glucose or fructose. Both of those are going to spike your blood sugar. Both of those are going to cause your hormones in the body to overreact. They're all bad for you. This is the latest on why you should not have these sugary drinks. American Heart Association's scientific session, University of Oklahoma Health Center Sciences study, quote, a woman's chance of getting heart disease greatly increases from just a couple of sugary drinks a day. Even those lucky enough to be able to eat and drink anything they want and not gain weight are still likely to develop heart disease. So there you have it. Two or more sugar-sweetened drinks a day, which is easy to do in many parts of America where it's warm or when women are being very athletic, and that doesn't help you at all, the fact that you're athletic and burning these extra calories because of what it does to the heart specifically. These risks were higher even when the women were normal weight. So it's not just about weight. Quote, most people assume that individuals who consume a lot of sugary sweetened drinks have an increase in obesity, which in turn increases their risk of heart disease and diabetes. Although this does occur, this study showed that risk factors for heart disease and stroke develop even when the woman did not gain weight. Now, if you want something sweet to drink that will not increase your weight or diabetes or heart disease, natural juices like apple juice won't, orange juice won't, grapefruit juice won't, and grape juice won't. They're all sweet, but they're good for you. Something else is good for you that we don't eat enough in our society is chia, C-H-I-A, little tiny seeds. They were a mainstay of the Aztecs because they could last a long time, and they were equally as important as corn and beans and amaranth, and you could take them, and what the natives would frequently do is when they were out foraging or hunting, they would put some of this, about a teaspoon, under the tongue, and it would gel from the saliva, and that provided a sustainable food when they were out and couldn't take a lot with them. Chia seeds are an excellent source of fiber and antioxidants, of calcium, and plant-based proteins, and they are a good source of the plant-derived omega-3 fatty acids. They are indeed a superfood. So I would suggest you have some chia seeds. One good way to do it is simply to take maybe 3 tablespoons of chia seed and throw it in your blender in the morning for your smoothie, or put it into a raw granola or into a hot oatmeal. It's great for you. Doesn't really have a taste of it in and of itself, but it's terrific. I want to make sure that we protect our body from the fumes we breathe, even when we don't see things in the air. They're there. Have you ever looked out of the window and the sun is shining in and suddenly you see all this particulate matter? And that's just the way the prism of the window was refracting on the particles. Now, if you turn on the light, you won't see any of that. Or if you get a different angle, you won't see it. But it's all there. When you walk in and you have your shoes on, everything on the bottom of your shoe dries, and then it wafts up into the air. Feces, blood, anything that you stepped on outside, it's now in your air. It's on surfaces. One of the reasons I leave my shoes outside. And you're much more comfortable walking around barefoot. It's healthier for you. And also is keeping the dirt out. But what about when you're in a car? Right now we have a lot of cab drivers. And I know a lot of them are very interested in health. I know because a lot of them stop off at a health food store on the Upper West Side and get their special Gary juices each day. That's what I am told in the morning when I go up to get my own juices when I'm in New York. And I'm talking about not a few, but dozens. And they're more likely to try to pay attention that they're down, right down near the ground there in that toxic traffic. What about all the truck drivers? Here is the latest reason why you should have some form of air purification device in your car. And they're easy to get and inexpensive. This is from Science Daily. This is published in the International Journal of Nanomedicine. Quote, nanoparticles, by the way, that means a tiny little particle, used as additives in diesel fuel can travel from your lungs to the liver. Recent studies conducted at Marshall University have demonstrated that nanoparticles of cerium oxide, common diesel fuel additives used to increase the fuel efficiency of automobile engines, can travel from your lungs to your liver, and this can cause liver damage. So, by the way, to show you how tiny these particles are, 1/40,000th the width of a hair. 40,000 times thinner than your hair. So, they're in the air. Everyone who drives a car, everyone who's out on the road, is going to be breathing them. Get yourself a little negative ionizer. You can wear it around your neck. No one even see it. I wear one. I don't go on an airplane or movie or any place where there are people without this because it creates a protective shield about a foot around your head. So that's one thing you can do to protect yourself. The U.S. population is getting fatter. I didn't think that was possible unless you actually start to sink whole states. But here's what Science Daily is saying. The vast majority of adults in the United States will be overweight or obese, and more than half will suffer from diabetes or prediabetes. That's according to Northwestern University School of Medicine and the American Heart Association scientific session occurring yesterday. Now, all you have to do is just walk down any street and you'll see this. You'll just see, and the question is why? These are not stupid people. And what will it cost us when people are sick from being overweight? They're projecting $1.1 trillion a year. That's $1 trillion a year. So we have a zero policy now in the United States for preventing anything. We won't prevent foreclosures. We won't prevent bankruptcy. We won't prevent a bad education. We won't prevent crime. We won't prevent anything because that's not where the money is. And also that would be blaming some people. And so we can't do that. And so instead, we just think that somehow we can eat all the stuff that you see advertised every day, take the medications you see advertised, live the lifestyle you see, and there's going to be a happy ending. There is no happy ending, ever, when you follow what orthodox anything has to tell you about anything. They're universally wrong about everything. Except they have the power, and therefore they'll never acknowledge they're wrong. And so, I'll give you an example. When I was doing my documentary, Prescription for Disaster, about 4 years ago, I filmed a professor of medicine out in Indiana. And the day that I was filming him, he had just put a sign in his front yard, house for sale. And I said, why are you selling your home? He said, well, when I had my heart attack and then a subsequent stroke, and I couldn't practice medicine anymore, and I couldn't teach, and I went through my savings, and I didn't have catastrophic health insurance, I've lost everything. And so we have to move to a smaller place and literally live off my wife's limited income. And I said, it was Prozac that did... No, not Prozac in his case. I said, when you took the anti-inflammatory Vioxx and you had your heart attack, then your stroke, did you ever think about all the patients you had given it to and all the other medical students you had taught that this was an acceptable therapy? And he said, no. He said, I couldn't live with that. When we see that there were 60,000 who died and 150,000 who were injured, I have to think that a lot of those deaths were because the advice I'd given to medical students who went out and practiced. And I said, I haven't met anyone who found anyone who apologized. No patients that I found have had a physician who gave them the drug, said, I'm sorry for what I did. I should have done my homework, and I didn't. No, we just don't have that capacity because we don't like to be that vulnerable. That's one of the reasons we try to share alternative approaches, so at least you're not stuck with just one approach. One last thing here, natural black birch reduces pain and lowers the risk of heart attacks. This is the latest study in this area. And black birch, by the way, is commonly used in herbal medicine. It's a natural, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. It's an oil of wintergreen just underneath its bark in the green layer known as the cambium. And so when a person eats the black birch twig or chews it in, or brews it in a tea, the methyl salicylate compounds that are in the oil effectively are absorbed through the body, and that's a natural pain treatment. And this is what the Native American used when it came to pain. So it actually tastes like wintergreen, and oil of wintergreen is the common name. And this is a classic compound from which aspirin is derived. But unlike aspirin and other pharmaceutical painkillers, which can cause serious and deadly side effects, like bleeding, taking black birch is safe and effective and has no side effects. And since black birch is a common tree that grows all across the East Coast, including in Central Park, means people have easy access to it. So, when you have pain and you want something natural, go into a health food store and ask for some black birch. And by the way, the relationship between glucose and vitamin C plays a huge role in health. From David Jockers, he says, vitamin C is made naturally in almost all living animals except humans and primates and guinea pigs. Dogs and cats produce their own vitamin C from ingested food they have metabolized into glucose. Humans must consume vitamin C from its food sources or they risk severe health problems. There is an intimate relationship between glucose and vitamin C that has a dramatic impact on immunity and overall cellular health. Most animals and plants are able to synthesize their own vitamin C. This is done through a biochemical pathway that depends upon four key enzymes which convert glucose to vitamin C. In mammals, the glucose is extracted from stored sugar, which is glycogen, and transformed into vitamin C, and that's produced in the liver. Humans lack the oxidase enzyme that is critical for the last step of vitamin C synthesis. And then it talks about how this happens. Now, here is an idea. I used to have a goat dairy up in Stone Ridge, and I had 40 goats, Alpine and Nubians, and I taught classes on the natural care for animals. And I was really a rescue station. I would take in animals that had been rejected or someone went broke or an animal had been abused, and I brought them back to health and found them a home, or if it was a wild animal, released them back into nature. And out of curiosity, I called Irwin Stone, who was the person who really introduced Lydenis Pauling, the Nobel Prize winner, to vitamin C. And the one who introduced Stone to vitamin C was Albertson Georgi, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering and isolating ascorbic acid. So I called first Stone, and then he gave me Albertson Georgi's number. I called him, and I said, here's a question. I watch goats eat, and I'm convinced that they never get sick because they produce enough vitamin C in their body. What is the likelihood that if a human being consumed enough vitamin C or produced enough vitamin C, that it would be far more than what we're taking in, assuming that we're taking in what we need to prevent scurvy, but not enough to be optimally healthy? And he called me back a couple days later and he said, why don't we try a little experiment? And it turns out that a little goat, maybe a 20-pound goat, can produce up to 40,000 milligrams of vitamin C per day. And that's how they stay so healthy. Well, then how much would a 150-pound man produce to stay healthy? So it's just an interesting concept that's never been fully evaluated, but one that I believe that should be evaluated. And that's why when I was working with people with cancer and AIDS and other life-ending diseases, end-stage hepatitis, and I suggested very high doses of vitamin C, the highest doses ever consumed by anyone at that point, and these people's diseases just turned around. I thought, well, gee whiz, if that's what it will do for a sick person, what will it do for a healthy person? And that's when a group of us runners who are vegan and healthy and never done drugs or alcohol or anything, smoking or anything like that, started taking a higher dose of vitamin C. And what it did, it just enhanced our overall immune system. You could see it in the blood chemistries that we were measuring every week through a blood lab. So what I'm saying is that the amount of nutrients that we have been told to consume to stay healthy is actually the bare minimum. And we are way under potentizing our body in phytonutrients, chlorophyll, healthy nutrients that would not store like a vitamin A, but a vitamin C. And understanding this will be the next major breakthrough in health sciences. And watch the dosages then that we're consuming. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to a break, come back, and then give you our issue of the day and ask you to call in. By the way, for those of you who are listening now over our sister stations, and especially BAI New York, sorry that we were preempted for the last 3 days. That would not have been my choice, but then again, I'm not in management. So if you miss something, you can always go. If you don't hear me live at noon, then go to progressiveradionetwork.com, and that's where you always hear me, and you can download any of those important shows we've had. On Monday's show, we have Jesse Ventura coming on. That'll be an interesting discussion, talking about fascism in the United States. Back in a moment.
It's a most unusual day. Feel like throwing my worries away. As an old native born Californian would say, it's a most unusual day. There's a most unusual sky. Not a sign of a cloud passing by. And if I want to sing, throw my heart in the ring. It's a most unusual day. There are people meeting people. There is sunshine everywhere. There are people greeting people. And a feeling of spring in the air. It's a most unusual
time. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. This is our issue of the day. This is from Norm Stampler from Yes Magazine. And Norm was Seattle's police chief from 1994 to 2000 and a police officer for 34 years. He is a member of the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition and the author of Breaking Rank, Top Cops, Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing, which was an article in The Nation magazine. We had the publisher of The Nation magazine on yesterday, too, for a very interesting interview. I'll quote this, then I'm going to ask you to call in and share your points of view. They came from all over, tens of thousands of demonstrators are from around the world, protesting the economic and moral pitfalls of globalization. Our mission as members of the Seattle Police Department to safeguard people, property, in that order. Things went well the first day. We were praised for our friendliness and restraint, though some politicians were epileptic at our refusal to make mass arrests for the actions of a few. Then came day two. Early in the morning, large contingents of demonstrators began to converge at a key downtown intersection. They sat down, refused to budge. Their numbers grew. A labor march would soon add additional thousands to the mix. We have to clear the intersection, said the field commander. We have to clear the intersection, said the operations commander. He agreed. From a bunker in the public safety building, standing alone on the edge of the crowd, I, the chief of police, said to myself, we have to clear the intersection. Oh, by the way, this is not Occupy Wall Street. This is when those of us were protesting globalization in Seattle a long time ago, 10 years ago. Why? Because of all the what-ifs. What if a fire breaks out in the Sheraton across the street? What if a person goes into labor on the 17th floor of the hotel? What if a heart patient goes into cardiac arrest in the high rise on the corner? What if there's a stabbing, a shooting, a serious injury, traffic accidents? How would an aid car, fire engine, or police cruiser get through this, that sea of people? The cop in me supported the decision to clear the intersection, but the chief in me should have vetoed it, and he certainly should have forbidden the indiscriminate use of tear gas to accomplish it, no matter how many warnings we bark through the bullhorn. My support for a militaristic solution caused all hell to break loose. Rocks, bottles, and newspaper racks went flying. Windows were smashed, doors were looted, fires ignited, and more gas filled the streets, with some cops clearly overreacting, escalating and prolonging the conflict. The battle in Seattle, as the World Trade Organization protests and their aftermath came to be known, was a huge setback for the protesters, for my cops, and the community. More than a decade later, the police response to Occupy movement, most disturbingly visible in Oakland, where scenes resembled a war zone, and where a Marine remained in serious condition from a police projectile, brings into sharp relief the acute and chronic problems of American law enforcement. Seattle might have served as a cautionary tale, but instead, U.S. police forces have become increasingly militarized, and it's showing in cities everywhere. The New York City Police Department's white shirt coating incident with pepper spray, the arrests of two student journalists at Occupy Atlanta, the declaration of public property as off-limits, and the arrests of protesters for supposedly trespassing. The paramilitary bureaucracy and the culture it engenders, a black-and-white world in which police unions serve above all to protect the brotherhood, is worse today than it was in the 1990s. Such agencies inevitably view protesters as the enemy, and young people, poor people, and people of color will forever experience the institution as an abusive militaristic force, not just during demonstrations, but every day in neighborhoods across the country. Much of the problem is rooted in a rigid command and control hierarchy based upon the military model. American police forces are beholden to archaic internal systems of authority whose rules emphasize bureaucratic regulations over conduct on the streets. An officer's hair length, the shine on his shoes, and the condition of his car are more important than whether he treats a burglary victim or a sex worker with dignity and respect. In the interest of discipline, too many police bosses treat their frontline officers as dependent children, whose help explains why many behave more like juvenile delinquents than mature, competent professionals. It also helps to explain why persistent pattern misconduct, including racism, sexism, homophobia, brutality, perjury, and corruption, do not go away, no matter how many blue ribbon panels are commissioned or how much training is provided. External political factors are also to blame, such as the continuing madness of the drug war. Last year, police arrested 1.6 million non-violent drug offenders. In New York City alone, 50,000 people, overwhelmingly black, Latino, or poor, were busted for possession of small amounts of marijuana. Some of it, we have recently learned, planted by corrupt narcotics officers. The counterproductive response to 9/11, in which the federal government began providing military equipment and training even to some of the smallest rural departments, has fueled the militarization of police forces. Everyday policing is characterized by a SWAT mentality. Every other 9/11 call, a military mission. What emerges is a picture of a vital public safety institution perpetually at war with its own people. The tragic results: raids gone bad, wrong homes hit, innocent people and family, pets shot and killed by police are chronicled all the time. It is ironic that those police officers who are busting up Occupy protesters are themselves victims of the same social ills the demonstrators are combating. Corporate greed, the slackening of essential regulatory systems, the abject failure of all three branches of government to safeguard civil liberties and to protect, did not provide basic human needs like health, housing, education, and more. With cities and states struggling to balance the budget while continuing to deliver public safety, many cops are finding themselves out of work. And as many Occupy protesters have pointed out, even as police officers help to safeguard the power and profits of the 1%, police officers are part of the 99%. There will always be situations: an armed and barricaded suspect, a man with a knife to his wife's throat, a school shooting rampage that required disciplined, military-like operations. But most of what police are called upon to do day in and day out requires patience, diplomacy, and interpersonal skills. I'm convinced it is possible to create a smart organizational alternative to the paramilitary bureaucracy that American policing has become. But that will not happen unless, even as we call bad apples from the police forces, we recognize that the barrel itself is rotten. Those are the comments of Norm Stampler, former Seattle police chief. I'd like your thoughts, please. I posted on my website today on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and GaryNall.com. I posted a picture of a paraplegic in a wheelchair in Washington, D.C., where two large police come up and then throw him, literally projectile throw him 6 feet, jump on him. He's profusely bleeding from his head, and they handcuff him. Why? Why? I see a 10-year-old being assaulted by police for carrying a sign. Why? I see SWAT teams raiding food co-ops in Los Angeles. Why? I see a door being kicked down in the state of Washington, Jonathan Wright's office, Tacoma, Washington, and Jonathan Wright's patients, nurse, and secretary suddenly have guns loaded, locked, and pointed at their head. For what? He had a preservative-free B complex from Germany? That's it. That was the only reason it happened. Overreaction? That's all the police do today is overreact. We need a completely different mindset. What bothers me is that we're not even discussing the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, America becoming a police state, which it is, America following a fascistic agenda, which it has for some time. Both most of the left and the right have been asleep on this. Only those who are and have been awake and protesting, but they've had no forums, because the official left and the official right does not like to even assume that there has been this movement. And it's far more than 1% engaged. It's about 35% of the American population engaged in the destruction of America's values and allowing, encouraging, actually embracing fascism. I'm Gary Knoll. Our number to call in to share your point of view is, by the way, the name of the post, if you want to look at it now, is the America You Recognize. Is this the America you recognize? Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Two quick things before we go to your calls in the studio. This is from Ellis Burbani, and it says, an increase in heat waves is certain, while heavier rainfall, more floods, stronger cyclones, landslides, and more intense droughts will occur across the globe because the Earth's climate is warming. And this is from a panel of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, urging countries to come up with disaster management plans to adapt to the growing risk of extreme weather events that are happening now and will only increase. So, to Rush Limbaugh, Rush, you may not like to read anything that's actual science, but there are over 3,000 scientific reports published in the peer-reviewed literature showing global warming is real. And the reason you have the heaviest rainfall, the heaviest snowfall, the worst ice storms, the largest hail, and at the same time had the hottest days, the drought that will not end, it's all from the same thing. And yes, we're all part of it. And for those who, like myself, believe that we should stop all hydrofracking and let your legislator know, and if you go to our website, we have videos, we have calls to action, we have all the groups, so there's no shortage of groups you can affiliate with who are doing something constructive to stop it, like the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. This is the latest. This is today. A new federal study finds wastewater from natural gas hydrofracking has higher levels of contaminants the deeper in the storage tank the samples are taken. These findings may be a key to preventing environmental damage from disposal of huge volumes of post-fracking water produced in the boom to exploit shale gas. So, not only is the water bad, it's more polluted and more concentrated in the pollutants than what we have been told. One more reason not to hydrofrack. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go to Greg Palast in about around 10 minutes. I want to get as many calls on as possible. In the studio right now is our producer, Richard Gale, and also our program director, Jason. Hi, Jason.
Jason.
Richard, you're on.
Hello, Gary. How are you? Jason is just coming in, but...
And Val's there also.
And Valerie's here. Right.
Good. We have a showing coming up and that I was informed about. Tell us about it,
okay.
Please.
Okay. Just two quick announcements. This coming Monday, November 21st, there will be a showing, and this is free of charge. There will be a showing at 7 p.m. of Knocking on the Devil's Door. Since you are out of town, I will be there as having been the producer for the documentary to take questions and answers. And then at 9 p.m. there will be a showing of Death by Medicine. That will be at the Theater for the New City. That's on 155th First Avenue between 9 and 10 streets. Okay, that's Theater for the New City, 155 First Avenue between 9th and 10th. And this is free of charge, and so
that's two. You know what you do, Richard? Do this. Get Jay to make copies of both films. Not only will they see this film for free, give them each a copy of each of those other two award-winning documentaries. Take home to give to friends.
We certainly will.
Let us spread the information. So it's a free showing of two films. I want to thank the film owner who called us and said they'd like, as a public service, because they were so moved after they saw both films, to show them without charging anyone. That's never done. And then do it this coming Monday. So Monday, a double showing of Knocking on the Devil's Door at 7 and Death by Medicine at, I guess, around 9.
It'll be about 9 o'clock will be for Death by Medicine.
We'll have members of my staff who produce these. And Val, are you going to be down there too?
Yes.
Because Valerie also was producer on this and also helped direct some of this. So, Val, these are two very important films. By the way, the one is now a finalist at the, Toronto International Film Festival?
Right. And also I want people to know that Knocking on the Devil's Door is in the Film Fest week. It's being screened. Hopefully we'll win an award out of that. And that's being shown at the Quad Cinema, which is at 34 West 13th Street in New York City. And that's on Sunday night at 6 o'clock. And now that's not free, but I do have two free VIP passes that I'd love to give to someone out there. And give me a call, give Val a call at 646-926-5441. 646-926-5441, and I'll give you two free passes to the showing of Knocking on the Devil's Door at the Quad Cinema.
Good. Richard, could you give the address of the movie theater for Monday night, please?
Oh, the Monday night one is the Theater for the New City, 155 First Avenue, and that's between 9th and 10th Streets.
Great. We aired a film there. AIDS Inc. Susan Sarandon. A lot of celebrities came to endorse it and speak afterwards. Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, thank them. I really appreciate them. I'm out on the road, or I would be there. I'm working every day, 20-hour days, and then traveling, so I can't be there. But members of the production staff and producers and people work intimately on this will be there to answer questions. Now, We have some calls here. Let's say hello to Dennis from New Jersey. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, good afternoon, Gary. I was calling about the fracking. The DRBC was scheduled to have a vote meeting on Monday morning in Trenton, New Jersey, and there was going to be a lot of people going there to voice their opposition to it. I got an email from Josh Fox, who did the movie Gaslands. I don't know if you're familiar with that film.
Sure I am.
About fracking. And he said, all your calls, all your emails, your pledges to swarm the DRBC in Trenton on November 1st, all of your pressure and all of your strength to stop fracking in the Delaware Basin for now. He said, what this cancellation means is the DRBC doesn't hold a meeting to vote down their regulations. I've only ever seen them vote to approve things, which means they would cancel the meeting if they no longer had 3 out of 5 commissioners voting in favor of fracking, which is exactly what they have done. They don't cancel meetings often, let alone votes. He said your voice made a tremendous difference, and he is humbled and proud and beyond thankful.
He deserves credit for leading this charge. It's an outstanding job he did. The film is exemplary. I ask people to watch Gasland. It is worth it. And we just have to keep putting the pressure, keep the phone calls, keep the letters going into the legislators and people in New Jersey. And we have all the calls to action of who to contact, who the people are, and which groups are working together cooperatively, and the whole hydrofracking community and their organizations, including the producer and the head publicist for Gasland. We're in our march and at the governor's office. So we're doing the same approach. Bring it all together. Anti-nuke, anti-fracking, together, and let the governor, let the legislators know we're not going to vote for you if you don't stop these. Thanks a lot. And let's say hello to Donald from New Jersey. Donald, you're on. John, you're on.
Hello, Gary, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, here's the thing. I heard that thing that you mentioned about the guy in the wheelchair is being thrown by the police in Washington, D.C. Then you also mentioned about the situation with the kid when he's holding a sign. I think that this country and the people who run the police departments and the governments around this country is absolutely disgusting. That would never happen with protests in France. That doesn't happen as much, okay, with protests in Sweden. I have a shortwave radio. I keep in touch with different things. And it seems to be this country doesn't give a damn about its own people except just these idiots, and not just these corporations, but in the government, and just work, and whether they work hard and wrap themselves around China and India and all this crap I've been hearing for like 15 years now from Clinton on down, even before Clinton. And this country's just becoming crap. I mean, the whole concept is stupid. It's not even treasonous. It's treasonous. It's traitorous against their own people. But it's also just dumb, okay? Now, if there was a bunch of people coming over the border trying to take these people's, American people's jobs and downsize wages and just let Americans sweat and struggle and work, like all that crap that you hear in the baby boomer generation and older, with some, I didn't say all, it'd be a different story. But when it comes to these banks and other stuff, you know, they're bailing out this one, Goldman Sachs, this and that, and this country's just becoming crap. I mean, our infrastructure's garbage. There's a bridge that's between Vermont and New York that's falling apart. And, you know,
John,
and all that.
I absolutely agree that we are in a crisis. Two ways of approaching it. One, have some more fiber tomorrow morning, John. Secondly, realize that the country is not crap. We're a great and noble country. I could show you millions of people who care about each other, the environment, respect life, vegans, people who are spiritual. Let us not give the power to those who are disempowered over how we want to feel. Let us give the power to those who are empowered at the spiritual level to guide us out of this. We are not going to allow our country to fall so completely on all of its ethics and morals on so many levels without showing that there are other approaches. That's what this forum is for. So we'll show solutions for every problem. It's not just focusing and empowering the problem. I understand your frustration. I can appreciate it. One thing we can do, we can stop privatizing prisons. When you privatize prison, and you then pay a high amount, $35,000 a year per incarcerated person, then you have an economic incentive to work the political system through Alex, which they have done, to make sure that we still carry arcane drug rules. We should abandon completely, give up entirely the war on drugs. We should disarm the war on drugs. We should stop privatizing prisons. We should not allow any nonviolent person to go to jail. We should have them work within community systems and make sure that they're getting the kind of counseling and support they need to reclaim a useful place in society. We have solutions. We just don't have the political power at this moment, but that's coming as long as you don't vote Democrat or Republican in the next election. Withhold the vote if it means voting for the worst of two. Wait for the independents to gain a forum. Thank you very much. Let's go in and say hello to Greg Pallas, standing by. I've given you his background, and Greg is the author of Vulture Picnic. Nice to have you back with us, Greg.
Glad to be with you, Gary, and I guess I'll also see you for WBAI in New York on December 5.
Greg, I want to hit three issues. I'm going to address them, then turn them over to you. Take them in that order I give them, all right?
All right.
First,
I'm listening.
There's no way we would have had the crisis and the economic meltdown without taking away the Glass-Steagall Act. Tell us who was really behind it, how it was worked, and why we should make those people accountable for participating in that. Secondly, we only know about the British Petroleum problem as far as the Deepwater Horizon blow-up, but what about the other incidences, the Arctic pipelines, the Exxon Valdez incidents, the prior offshore drilling accidents and corruption and cover-ups on British Petroleum trying to save costs? Give us that. And lastly, give us your insight on the role that oil companies, multinational globalization, drains the resources and money from developing countries. What impact do we have on impoverishing other people because of our unrestrained need to capitalize on those countries?
That's a tall order. That's why I wrote the Vulture's Picnic, so you could read the answers. And by the way, it's still legal to read, I understand, until Patriot Act 3 kicks in, Gary. So, yeah, let's start with Glass-Steagall, and I know you're referencing Chapter 12, Generalissimo of Globalization, Vulture's Picnic. Here's what happened. Glass-Steagall is the wall that Franklin Roosevelt put up between the casinos, known as investment banks, and the place where you stick your money, that safe known as a commercial bank, where you have your savings account. That is, and there was a wall that FDR erected because we had a collapse of the banking system in 1929, 1930, and that was a solution to get the gamblers out of the banking system. We made a deal. You stop gambling with our money. You put that in a different company that we don't guarantee, and we will, we will guarantee deposits in the safe banks. Well, back in 1997, 1998, a guy named Robert Rubin, our Secretary of Treasury, working with Bill Clinton, Larry Summers, Timmy Geithner. Summers now, who just was our Obama's economic czar, Timmy Geithner still our Secretary of Treasury, decided to what they call deregulate the banking system. Now, understand, when they use the term deregulate, let's call it decriminalize. These guys are gambling, in effect, with public money. By removing the wall between the piggy bank banks and the gambling casino banks, we, in effect, you and I, are the suckers who are guaranteeing these guys blowout weekend in Vegas. If they hit the jackpot, they keep it. And that's what they did with their massive bonuses. And we're massive, massive bonuses. Robert Rubin went straight from Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton. Within 6 months, he was co-chairman of one of these combined new casino banking operations called Citigroup, which was Citibank and investment banks. Rubin had been chairman of Goldman Sachs. He earned a payment of $110 million. I want to repeat that. One guy, Secretary of Treasury, who changed the rules to create Citigroup, was then hired by Citigroup, gets $110 million personally, and the combination quickly bankrupted that bank. Now, when it went bankrupt, did he turn back his $110 million? No. He used his lobbying power to get $40 billion bailout for Citibank, plus nearly $1 trillion in guarantees for Citibank. You and me, we paid for that. That now, what they've done, combining basically gambling with public money, used to be a crime. So decontrol is the wrong word. Deregulation is the wrong word. It's decriminalizing criminal behavior. What I have in Vulture's Picnic, though, is some of the inside stuff, which is really valuable to know. If, for example, how do you deregulate the U.S. banks, and at the same time, Gary, if the other banking systems in the world are safe and not deregulated and decriminalized, well, people are going to move their money to where it's safe. So you have to basically pull out all the barriers in all the nations at once, 153 nations, and you do that. The scheme was they were going to use the threat of trade war against any nation that refused to decontrol their banks. And I was able to get my hands on a memo, and all through Vulture's Picnic, you have these inside memos. By the way, those who don't know Greg Palast, I'm an investigative reporter for BBC Television. All this material goes on BBC Television. It's very carefully vetted by the most prestigious news network on the planet. So this ain't just, you know, stuff that just kind of flew through the window and we haven't checked out. I have an internal cable from Timmy Geithner, confidential, to Larry Summers, our Secretary of Treasury, to what became our economic czar. Back during the Clinton years, from Geneva, where Geithner said, okay, the only way to work this, they've been having meetings with the biggest banks in secret, and the only way to rip apart the banking structure of the planet, which ended up with Greece on fire and everything else, is to basically threaten any nation that doesn't deregulate with trade strangulation. They're particularly concerned about Brazil because Brazil did not allow derivatives, did not allow Morgan Bank to operate there, did not allow Goldman Sachs to operate within Brazil. These are all operations outlawed. You can't trade. You can't bring poisons, guns, weapons, diseases, or financial derivatives into Brazil. It's against the law there. And it just drove them nuts. So they got all nations except Brazil, and they start putting the heat on Brazil. It's an internal cable. But before they pulled the trigger on destroying the international system of regulating banks, it said, please call these numbers. This was Geithner to Summers. And it was the names and the personal phone numbers of the five biggest banking CEOs, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Citibank, and then there was Goldman Sachs as well. In other words, if you think that these guys get together in a room and plan how to take apart the planet, and they all call each other, and Timmy Geithner wouldn't move without calling them, you'll actually see the memo, and you'll actually have those live phone numbers. And in fact, until my book was released this week, with their phone numbers in it, with that document in it, with the live phone numbers, those phone numbers are actually quite live, and you could call the CEO of Goldman yourself, and someone did. One of my readers did and got a hold of the CEO of Citibank. Said, by the way, have you read Greg Powell's new book? I kid you not, but of course the numbers have all been changed since then. So that's your number one. And now, Gary, what was your number two? I don't want to get this wrong.
British Petroleum.
This is BP, right?
What don't we know about the crimes they engaged in other than the Deep Horizon spill?
This is British Petroleum, BP, as it likes to be called now, which is beyond petroleum, right? Yeah, way beyond. BBC and Guardian newspapers asked me to investigate, and that's one of the core stories of Vulture's Picnic. I see the deep water blow up on TV. Now, I used to be an investigator, racketeering investigator, before I was investigative reporter. And I directed the Exxon Valdez investigation. So I had a feeling that something was going on here other than a terrible accident. Sure enough, within hours, we get a cable from a ship floating in the Caspian Sea that's in Central Asia saying, this has happened before, but I cannot speak through this official system. I set up a secure communication with the source inside the Caspian nation of Azerbaijan. If people listening don't know what Azerbaijan is, well, we Americans don't know that stuff until the 82nd Airborne arrives there, you know, like Mogadishu and Kabul and Saigon. Its capital is Baku. I take off for Azerbaijan, and you follow me in the book, Azerbaijan, and to find out what happened. And sure enough, we discover that there was an exact same blowout 2 years before the Deepwater Horizon in the Caspian Sea, a BP rig operated by Transocean, which exactly same as Deepwater, BP Transocean. And the problem was the blowout in the Caspian was caused by quick-set cement, cheap stuff. In other words, time is money for oil companies, and the quicker the cement sets that supposedly caps these wells, the quicker they make their money. Less cost of renting those expensive rigs. So quick-set cement, the problem with quick and cheap is that it don't work. So it blew out. You had a massive blowout, just like the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf, except they covered it up because it was Azerbaijan is a dictatorship, what I call in Vulture's Picnic the Islamic Republic of BP. They installed the president. First, you'll see in the book, there was a $30 million bribe paid to one president of Azerbaijan to get him to give BP the exclusive rights to drill. And by the way, BP, we sent notes to BP saying, if it's not true, tell us. BP, in their official note back to us, by the way, says, does not deny the bribery, does not deny that it was involved in a coup d'etat to overthrow the president when he didn't move quick enough to give BP its oil, does not deny that there was a blowout before the Deepwater Horizon. They simply said the response to our network was that BBC has followed all rules and regulations, whatever that means. They don't deny the blowout. That's serious. because it was the same cause, and they went before BP executives under oath, November 2009, went before the United States Congress and said, because remember, it was hard
Greg,
for BP
Greg, I'm
to
gonna
get
ask
that
you
drill.
Just to, I'm going to ask you to hold your thought for 1 second. Mm-hmm. Many of our stations around the United States, we're going to say goodbye for today's show. And for those of you who want to continue listening to Greg Palast for the next 6 minutes, explore this, you can go to progressiveradionetwork.com. Also, remember, Sunday evening, 8 p.m., I will be doing on progressiveradionetwork.com my once-a-week complete health and nutrition program. So, Greg, let us continue. Tell us about this.
Okay. So BP and other oil company executives get up before the United States Congress and say, because, by the way, the Department of Energy was and Interior were not going to give them drilling, deep water drilling permits in the Gulf. It was known to be dangerous. But they got up before Congress and said, override the Department of Interior because it's safe. We haven't had any problem with deep water drilling. We haven't had any problem with these methods. And they knew. They knew that the same exact thing had happened in the Caspian Sea.
Why would they could be found today? They could be found guilty of subordinating perjury.
Well, there's perjury, and there's also I used to be in the old days when Rick Perry called me. He wanted me to change Vulture's Picnic to Job Creator's Picnic. When I was with the government in the old days, we'd cuff these guys. This is racketeering. This is serious fraud, and it is manslaughter because you're turning an accident when you know willful negligence, when you know the methods you are using are dangerous. You can willfully conceal that fact because you want to keep it cheap, and then it blows up on you literally, not just figuratively. It blows up, and 11 guys get incinerated, vaporized. At that moment, your accident becomes a homicide. And I can tell you, in the old days, we actually used to cuff people for this, including big corporations, big nuclear companies, et cetera, that we grabbed. That doesn't happen anymore. You get, instead of jail time, you get bonuses.
Okay, but Greg, I want to get back to a point.
Guys are getting away with it.
Greg, a question for you. Mm-hmm? Is it not also true that anyone who would have been aware of their crimes that they denied could be held accountable for covering them up in our government?
Well, that's what, I mean, if, like I say, I used to do these cases for the government, and that's the way I always read the law. You read these guys their rights. This is serious stuff. You're perjuring yourself before the United States Congress. You're committing, it's called willful concealment. It's a predicate crime to the racketeering laws. I mean, this is a serious business. Either, first of all, against
would
the company,
Cheney
massive,
have, would,
massive
would,
civil fines.
Would Cheney have known of this previous problem they had?
Now, that's interesting because, for example, that cheap junk method of capping wells, that's a Halliburton method, that's number one, and the guy seems to have some connection there. The other is that, and here's why they knew. Here's why they knew. We did get in, my Guardian paper has access to the wiki cables, and we got a wiki cable that said that not only did British Petroleum know, but the oil companies knew, the other oil companies knew, because they were partners, and they were screaming, what happened with our rig out there because we're not making any money? It's the biggest rig in the world, and we're not making any money. What's going on? So they knew, and here's the ugly, ugly thing. Condoleezza Rice knew, too. The cables went to her. So she knew when the other oil companies... The American oil companies partnered up with British Petroleum in Azerbaijan, knew about the rig blowout. They were complaining, but they all wanted British Petroleum to pay a bigger share of their lost oil, but they wanted to keep it hushed up. And the Bush administration, we know Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, knew it.
But the President of the United States would have known, because every morning the President of the United States is given a review of all important data from Homeland Security Director gathered from the 16 major intelligence agencies. That's why the new sound cannons used in New York against the protesters, Barack Obama proved that. His National Security Advisor and his Homeland Security Director would have told him what they were going to be doing because it was a joint effort coordinated out of Homeland Security. So Barack Obama was involved in putting down all the protesters. People have to understand the politics of who consults the president every morning. Condoleezza Rice was national security advisor at that point, not Secretary of State. So she would have been responsible. Also, everyone in the National Security Agency would have known because of Operation Echelon, which monitors every phone call and email and computer wire looking for anything that will raise a red flag. That would have been a red flag on a big-time basis. So
oh, yeah,
all
absolutely.
These people are complicit. We're out of time. I've got 1 minute to wrap it up before Danny Schechter's show. Give us the final moment here.
The final moment is that the Deepwater Horizon was a homicide, not an accident. And this stuff continues right now. If you get the Vultures Picnic, I also go up to the Arctic. You know that Barack Obama just approved drilling in the Arctic Sea above the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And in the book, we're there with the Eskimos, and that's the end for them. But it's also the beginning of the end for us. And the important thing is that, for me, is that this is investigative reporting that you need to hear, and that I'm really glad that, you know, we're not going to hear it anywhere else but Gary Null's show. We're not going to hear it anywhere else but PRN. So I want people to understand how important the outlet is that you're listening to. I want them, obviously, to go to vulturespicnic.org, and you can download the first chapter of the book for free, because I want people to have the core information no matter what. You don't have to buy the book. Just vulturespicnic.org, excerpt, download it. There's films there, too, from Azerbaijan, because I was arrested, by the way, Gary, when I was there. They took my film from my BBC cameras, took our film, but they didn't take my pen, and that had one of those little Austin Powers pen cameras in it. So we got that. We still got the stuff out. So you get to see it, and I'm glad that you've got Gary Null to help me bring this out, because I, you know, my reports were last night at the top of the BBC television news worldwide, nowhere in the United States except right here. That's the only place you're going to hear this now. And I do appreciate
Greg, you've always got to get the word out. We've always got your back, and you know that you have a forum here. So all the best to you on getting the word out, and we'll spread that and provide more information on Vultures Picnic. All the best to you, my friend.
Bye.
Greg Pallas, my guest. We're out of time. Stay tuned for Danny Schechter, the News Dissector.
Mr. Man, and I can't tell you.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.
It must be something.